With gas prices forcing many to rethink driving habits, there's a group of car owners on a quest for the, quote, ultimate in fuel efficiency. They're called hypermilers. These drivers claim they can double their gas mileage just by changing their behavior behind the wheel. Patrick Madden of member station WAMU went out with a group of them.
I meet Kent Johnson in a parking lot outside Laurel, Maryland. He is leaning against his red Chevy Aveo hatchback, holding his right shoe.
You drove here with one shoe off.
Right, the accelerator foot, so that you can feel the pedal pressure a little bit easier. You know, when you're trying to eke that extra little bit, then just small things can add up.
Most of Johnson's techniques are simple. Slow down, ease up on the accelerator, coast in neutral downhills.
You know, I drive with my shoe off. That's extreme.
But extreme is what Johnson and the hypermilers are about.
Switching from driving so-called normally to hypermiling, it's a huge shift in thinking.
Curtis Adams is a clinical psychologist. He started hypermiling about 6 months ago.
Some people do it for environmental reasons. That's not at the top of my list, honestly. The environment I'm concerned about is my wallet.
To gauge my skills, the group sends me out with Adams on a 10-mile loop. He promised not to critique any of my abnormal driving habits, but as I park my large gas-guzzling SUV after our trip, it becomes too much.
See, now, we wouldn't park like this ordinarily. I fussed at Andy for doing this. So you're wasting gas by backing up, whereas their parking space is over there where you can head out. So you can pull all the way to the front of the space. When you come out, put the car in gear and head straight out. You don't have to back up and waste gas.
That's the way we should have parked.
Absolutely. That's where I would have parked.
After my terrible parking job, Kent Johnson greets us for the moment of truth. The group had installed a miles per gallon meter in my car for the short trip.
What kind of numbers did he get?
So your trip miles per gallon were 21.1 miles per gallon.
And you were thinking 8 miles per gallon. Look at that.
And there were periods of coasting where he was getting 111.
Mm-hmm.
There was one period when he had that infinite mileage, 9999. So.
Okay.
The group breaks down my performance, highlighting every misstep. Stop-and-go driving, too much braking, liberal use of the AC. They decide to bring in their heavy hitter, Mark Schmitz, to show me hypermiling firsthand. He averages 50 miles per gallon for a tank of gas, but Schmitz has an advantage.
It says 06 Civic Hybrid from Honda, and away we go.
Schmitz's eyes stay glued to the monitors on his dashboard.
So I'm getting 75, 80 miles per gallon just coasting down this hill.
At every turn or hill, instant feedback.
See, now because I'm accelerating up this hill, I'm below 40 miles per gallon. I'm hating life.
Some of his more extreme maneuvers can get you in trouble. Take this example at a stop sign.
Here's a famous hypermiling stop. Dun, dun, dun.
So, what did you just do there?
It was a 7-mile-an-hour roll through a stop sign. So,
what do cops call it?
They probably give me a ticket, so.
Hypermilers say the easiest way to save gas is obeying the speed limit. But Curtis Adams admits the sluggish pace, the slow rolling stops, the shoeless pedal foot, well, it can be hard on his family. He says his wife usually takes her own car. For NPR News, I'm Patrick Madden.
And for tips on hypermiling, go to npr.org. Here's a recipe for a successful American high school. Take 4 parts traditional values, 2 parts classical learning, and mix well in a community known for strong Christian values and high incomes. This educational concoction has worked well for the Classical Academy in Colorado Springs. NPR's Larry Abramson paid a visit as part of a series on innovative high schools.
Tom Clemens knows a thing or two about what high schools still call civics. His students expect that. They also expect moral advice in the form of his famous life lessons.
Some of the best things in life are those that you're going to have to wait for and work hard for. And I use the example of having to wait for a long time to find the right spouse.
Sound like Sunday school? Well, this is a public charter school, one that features traditional teaching and traditional values. Students are quick to tease Clemens when he recounts how he waited for the right woman to marry him.
She was in college, and her dad wanted her to finish college, and I was already out of college, so I had to wait a couple years, you know, to marry her.
But students here listen, even if they do it with a slight smirk. Clemens used to teach across the street at the Air Force Academy. Now he and his family feel right at home in this charter school in the shadow of Pikes Peak.
We found a climate here at the Classical Academy that's not just one-sided. We found in public schools, which we've been a part of in the past as well, people who might have more conservative beliefs, perhaps, are really a vast minority or looked down upon somehow.
The founding parents of the Classical Academy wanted to create a close-knit K-12 program focused on strong values as well as high academic standards. The route to those high standards is through an ancient series of steps known as the trivium. Students first learn the grammar of a subject, the basic knowledge, dates, and events. Then they move on to the logic, delving deeper into subjects and how to support their conclusions with facts. Finally, they reach the rhetoric stage when they're supposed to think and argue on their own. It's not that easy to understand, but it appears to be having some effect. The Classical Academy regularly scores among the top 10 schools in the state. Step into a classroom, and it's tough to discern exactly how instruction here is different than at other schools. The day I visited Wes Jolly's class, his approach to teaching the impact of Bob Dylan's music on the 1960s looked pretty familiar.
Do you hear how this could be a song that would be adopted by the Civil Rights Movement?
It's a bit odd to hear Dylan's music and watch the tumult of the 60s on a PBS documentary in a classroom full of well-groomed kids in khakis and white shirts, all of them following the school's dress and hair codes. I heard lots of students openly complain about the dress code, but they still follow it. Wes Jolly, another former military man, says that despite the focus on order, the school wants kids to question the rules.
We talked about the Students for Democratic Society yesterday protesting about dress codes, and there's a dress code here. So that gets the students' attention, talking about, well, there was dress codes in colleges and there were people protesting against that. Well, then maybe we should do the same thing.
In fact, founders of the school say the Classical Academy is meant to question behavior common in public schools, the cheating, the lack of respect for learning.
This is our Titan team, and I'm buzzing through the announcements real quick. That's
Classical Academy students gather twice a week in Titan teams named after the school's mascot. It's a kind of homeroom meant to embrace kids who otherwise might get lost in a big school with 500 students. And it's a way of reinforcing school values. I asked one member of the team, Allison Miller, does she feel sheltered growing up in such a homogeneous environment where good behavior and studiousness are considered the norm?
I'm in this group where there's a bunch of kids from other schools, and they come and they tell me all these bad things that they did over the weekend and such. They also call me sheltered, but my opinion, I think that we know about it, but we know what not to do.
The sense of shared values clearly binds the school together. Whose values are we talking about? Well, Russ Sojourner, principal of the junior high here, says students and families do not question certain basic truths.
Justice is a good thing, and kids should know that. At the crux of it, mercy is a good thing, and kids should understand that. And honesty is a good thing.
That argument may be easier to make here in Colorado Springs, a center for some of the largest, most active evangelical churches in the state. Leaders of the school say they are open to all comers, but the school's reputation and its location mean that this affluent, largely white school attracts a steady supply of believers.
It's assumed, kind of. It's never really talked about up front, but it's definitely assumed that we're all, I would say, Christian mostly. Yeah.
Sydney Anderson, a senior, was unwinding on a couch in the senior lounge, home to the school foosball table. Anderson says the school's focus on good behavior and traditional academics can lead to a kind of naivete. The bubble popped last year, she says, when administrators learned that some students were drinking at weekend parties.
It was kind of like everybody had a secret life and it suddenly came forth. Like there was this huge partying scandal with drugs, and it hit the administration really hard. Like they were just like, what? At TCA?
Oh, I was part of it. I was a big part of it.
That's Caleb O'Leary sitting next to Sydney Anderson on the couch.
It's not that the school's cracked down, it's that most of us have made life changes, I would say.
It was just really shallow.
Fusion changed lives at this school. Like Fusion. It was a spiritual retreat.
Fusion is a spiritual retreat conducted by an off-campus club that addressed the drinking problem. Administrators say they have nothing to do with such efforts, but they say this is another way for this community's values to shine through. TCA dealt with the partying as a family would, they say, through constructive meetings without any expulsions. And Principal Peter Hilt says the issue also proved that his student body is diverse.
One of the nice things about our school is I think you have students that confound some of those stereotypes. They do have a certain appearance, but there isn't nearly as much of a monolithic perspective as people outside the community attribute to us.
Hilt says this is a public charter school. Religion plays no active role here. But as at many charters, the Classical Academy clearly benefits from the fact that students all sign on to a common mission. There's no shortage of people who want to be part of that mission. Right now, there's a waiting list of 7,000 students. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
As part of our series on innovative schools, Larry has visited a high school that teaches Henry David Thoreau in the Vermont woods and an experimental school in Minnesota which has neither classes nor teachers. Hear those stories and others in the series at NPR.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Teachers' unions are often blamed for protecting teachers who've simply burned out or who should never have been allowed to teach in the first place. In a few cities, though, teachers' unions have spearheaded a controversial policy to purge their school districts of incompetent teachers. It's called peer review. And no school system in the country has been doing it longer than Toledo, Ohio. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Every year for the past 27 years, a panel of administrators and teachers in Toledo has met behind closed doors to discuss teachers who've been deemed incompetent.
And I remind everyone that all of our proceedings are confidential.
Fran Lawrence, president of the Toledo Federation of Teachers, usually presides over these day-long hearings. They're held in a colorless, windowless room. 9 members of the peer review committee sit at several tables arranged like a horseshoe. Today, the first case involves a veteran honors teacher who, by all accounts, has lost control of her students.
The children have gotten past disrespect. They're just downright vile. I don't know how else to put it. They're nasty beyond all belief.
There's no rapport at all with students.
Jim Galt is a teacher's former supervisor. Sharon Gerhardt is a fellow teacher.
She would literally leave the room to go to the bathroom and come back, and there'd be a filing cabinet in front of the door. Or they would lock her out. You know, and when honors kids start to do those kind of behaviors, this is not right. This is disrespectful.
Her excuse is the kids aren't like they used to be. And she'll say that over and over and over and over.
We thank you for your comments this morning.
Thank you.
After weighing the teacher's 33 years of service against her reluctance to accept help, the committee comes to a decision. This teacher will get a second chance and lots of training, including a mandatory summer course on classroom discipline. The ruling is surprisingly quick. Usually the committee takes longer to evaluate months of evidence and testimony. Every single teacher must go through the peer review program during their first year in the Toledo Public Schools. It doesn't matter if they're just out of college or years of classroom experience. Of the 132 teachers hired and evaluated this school year, 13 were terminated. The man who created the peer review program is Dal Lawrence, a former president of the Toledo Federation of Teachers.
Here we're doing two things. One, we want to find out who's good enough to teach in Toledo and who's not. And two, we want to shorten the learning curve from 5 years to 2 semesters. And we can pretty well do that.
In other words, if a teacher is incompetent, you don't have to wait 5 years to prove it. Lawrence says a bad teacher can do a lot of damage in 5 years. That was the problem he wanted to address when he came up with the idea in the late 1970s. The union voted for peer review in 1981.
So here's this crazy union president out in Toledo doing this something that nobody had ever done before.
Yeah, crazy like a fox, because what Lawrence actually did was unheard of. he wrestled the district's teacher evaluation policy away from school principals.
They'd always done it, and they had done it badly, as most administrators do in this country. So it was a struggle.
Lauren says principals seldom know what to look for. Teachers are less likely to get help, and incompetent teachers are rarely dismissed. Under peer review, a team of master teachers called consultants meticulously monitors and evaluates teachers in several areas: how they prepare, plan, and present lessons, how well they know the material they teach, how they engage and discipline students. Even a teacher's punctuality and dress are scrutinized. A recommendation to terminate a teacher for doing poorly in these areas can be overturned, but it almost never is. A teacher can appeal, but that's rare too. Toledo's peer review policy has withstood three lawsuits, and union members today overwhelmingly support it. For good reason, says David Strom, general counsel at the American Federation of Teachers, the nation's second largest teachers union.
A union's job is not to defend every teacher, no matter what that teacher has done, particularly if that teacher is not competent and capable.
The AFT endorsed peer review way back in 1984 under then-President L. Shanker, who argued that the union could not protect teachers' basic tenure rights unless teachers were willing to weed out those who didn't belong in the classroom. Peer review is, after all, supposed to protect all teachers from capricious or arbitrary termination. Joshua Singer, though, disagrees. He was forced to resign this school year.
There's nowhere to turn, and again, there's no grievance process. I knew I was in a losing situation. You know, I've got a family, I've got a house.
Singer, a special education teacher, started in the Toledo Public Schools in 2000. He says he got good reviews as an English teacher. He left for a few years, got his master's in special education, and was rehired last fall to teach at Robinson Middle School. This time, though, he says it was like being thrown to the wolves.
When I first walked in, I had never seen the level of insolence, the disrespect, the profanity, not used to authority. They don't trust people.
Robinson Middle School is, by all accounts, a tough school.
Let's go down here, up the halls, let's go!
Right outside Singer's classroom this morning, a security guard walks up and down the hallway screaming into a bullhorn. Kids ignore him. Singer ushers his students into class. All of them are classified cognitively delayed. With an IQ of between 50 and 70, it takes them longer to learn the most basic skills. But Singer insists they've all done okay this year, and he's had a good relationship with them. Singer's relationship with his consultant, the teacher who evaluated him, is another matter.
We never had a good relationship, either personally or professionally. We didn't see things philosophically on the same level. And I really think that my consultant somehow held this against me. The fact that I could relate to these kids and that they like me and that it didn't always have to be yes sir, no sir, and just sit down and be quiet and read out of a book.
Singer says he deserved another chance. He considered suing, but now he just wants to leave Toledo and teach somewhere else. The peer review committee would not discuss Singer's case, but Kevin Wade, a master teacher in the program for the past 3 years, says that recommending a teacher's termination is hard on everybody.
It's not a good feeling, but it's a feeling of knowing that you're upholding the integrity of the profession.
And that, union officials say, is why Toledo's peer review policy has spread to 70 school districts, mostly in Ohio, Connecticut, and California. Even the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers union, has dropped its long-standing opposition to peer review. Del Lawrence, the maverick union leader who started it all, says that in the 27 years peer review has been in place, he has never regretted his role in having a bad teacher fired.
If you ask me what kinds of people don't make it, the biggest group of people would be those who don't have stage presence. They're afraid of the kids. The second group are people who are just plain disorganized. The third group is a very much smaller group, thank goodness, and that is a group of people who don't know a damn thing and ain't about to find out.
Still, I asked Lawrence, if peer review is so good at removing these kinds of teachers from the classroom, why hasn't it put a dent in the woeful academic performance of students in Toledo? His answer, imagine how much worse it would be without it. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Since Louisa May Alcott's Little Women was first published 140 years ago, generations of girls have wished they were Jo, the second oldest of the four March sisters whose trials and tribulations are celebrated in the book. Headstrong, independent, and determined to be a writer and forge her own way in the world, Jo was a feminist before feminism was born. In our latest installment of the series In Character, NPR's Lynn Neary considers the long-lasting influence of Jo March.
For me, Little Women was more than just a book. It was a parallel world. Because just like the March sisters, I came from a family of four girls. So Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy became templates against which to compare myself. As the youngest, I couldn't possibly be Meg, the calm, collected oldest. But I was certainly no Amy, vain, spoiled, self-centered Amy. Good, kind-hearted Beth appealed to me, but in the end, she dies. So, of course, like every other girl who ever read Little Women, I wanted to be Jo, creative, strong-minded, and independent. But the competition was tough because, of course, my sisters also saw themselves as Jo. And even now, the question nags, which of us was the most like Jo? To find out, I called on my friend Mary Campbell, who grew up with us.
It was Jean.
I knew you were going to say that.
Sorry, Lynn.
So here I am, a grown woman.
And you're jealous.
And once again, you're crushing my aspirations by telling me that I could never be Jo.
But there were bits of Jo in all of you.
Bits of Jo. Small consolation, even if it is true. In my heart of hearts, I knew I could never be Jo. She was an ideal. Not only the kind of woman I wanted to be, she was the kind of woman Louisa May Alcott wanted to be.
She's very much a fantasy for Louisa May Alcott herself.
Children's book expert Anita Silvey. Little Women, says Silvey, was not Louisa May Alcott's idea. It was her publisher's. He wanted Alcott to write a girl's book. So Alcott drew on what she knew, her life with her sisters.
And so she wrote their story, but she very much wrote their story as she would have liked it to have been. She really softens the hard edges of her life. She makes Jo a much more lovable, accepted character than Louisa May Alcott herself ever was.
At a time when women's lives were restricted to hearth and home, says Sylvie, Jo represented the possibility of another kind of life.
You know, such divergent people as, say, Simone de Beauvoir said that she loved Jo because they shared the same horror of sewing and housekeeping and love of books. So Jo always makes you think that anything is possible, and anything is possible for a woman.
But I would soon discover something of a backlash against this idealized vision of a woman, loving sister, good daughter, best friend, career woman, and devoted wife. And who would guess that I would hear that backlash in a leafy suburban neighborhood where a mother-daughter book club meets?
This is the book that I found at the library that has the same illustrations I read. I was so excited to find it.
Vera Ashworth loved Little Women when she was just around the age of the girls in this book club. 12-year-old Maisie Deans is one of a new generation of Jo March fans.
I loved the book, and I loved Jo, and I just loved her character and how she was rebellious, but she still was good.
Mostly the girls liked Jo, though they disagreed with her decision to turn down a marriage proposal from the rich and handsome Laurie, her friend and next-door neighbor. And they thought Professor Bear, the man she does marry, was too old for her. But they were impressed by Jo's lack of vanity, especially when she cut off her thick chestnut hair, her one beauty, and sold the locks to get money to help her family. 11-year-old Emily Martin thought Jo was a little reckless sometimes, but she admired her anyway.
She spoke her mind. She was the one who was like a boy, she tells herself, and she doesn't really care what other people think. I really admire her and wish I could like live up to her standards and stuff.
But there's the rub. Who could possibly live up to Jo's standards? Mandy Katz, one of the mothers in the group, said rereading the novel made her sad.
It saddened me that I'd liked it so much when I was a kid, and I feel like it was a big influence on me in what we should aspire to, but in some ways it was a pernicious influence, because the mother even tells them, and the sisters tell each other, how important it is to be liked by people. And I think that we spend way too much effort and energy as women trying to live up to that ideal.
For Rachel Moon, returning to Little Women was a revelation. She realized that as a child she had liked the book because everybody told her she should.
And it was only reading it again that I realized that I didn't really like the book. I liked Jo the best of them, but I really didn't like Jo either.
Why not? What didn't you like about Jo?
That family was just too good. And I think part of the thing that bothered me when I was growing up was that it made me feel very guilty because I knew I couldn't be that good.
Ironically, for Mandy Katz, it was not the idealized Joe she wanted to read about as an adult. It was the real Louisa May Alcott, who, unlike her character, never married.
Louisa May Alcott was the Joe that I would have liked to see. The one who stayed independent, who supported her family because she was a working woman who was able to earn off the, you know, the output of her mind. So yeah, I felt that she had to betray a little bit of herself to write Joe in as yet another little woman who marries and looks up adoringly at the man who comes into her life.
But Karen Deans argued that Joe deserves to be understood in the context of her time, when options were limited and choosing not to be married meant the lonely existence of spinsterhood.
I don't think she wanted to be alone. And the whole old maid thing at 25 is kind of daunting. I mean, you think of putting it in its time. I mean, we can all look back where we are right now and sort of say, oh, yeah, you know, they were so stifled. They were so submissive. And, you know, this was the time and this is what they had to look for.
And though Joe may have been an impossible ideal, she was, as Vera Ashworth pointed out, an inspiration.
I think for all of us who had fond memories of her, she inspired us to go on and do something and believe in ourselves.
And as the girls in this book group were discovering Joe March for the first time, they were also watching Hillary Clinton's historic run for the presidency. Like so many other women her age, one of Hillary Clinton's favorite books is Little Women. And I'd be willing to bet her favorite character is Joe. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Go to NPR.org if you'd like to see a clip of Winona Ryder playing Joe March or read the first chapter of Louisa May Alcott's novel. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. For much of the 20th century, the U.S. Navy used most of the Puerto Rican island of Vieques for target practice. 5 years ago, the Navy left the island and left behind a federal Superfund site after spending decades dumping toxic waste. And at the same time, the presence of the Navy protected the island from development. So Vieques has one of the world's last pristine bioluminescent bays. But that's changing, as Ann Dornfeld reports.
On a moonless night, an electric boat full of tourists glides across Mosquito Bay. When the boat stops, everyone slips into the water, and from their giggles, you'd think they'd found the fountain of youth.
My feet are glowing.
They really like my chest hair.
Every time the swimmers move, they're trailed by bright blue light. It comes from microscopic plankton in the water that light up when they sense movement. This bay is considered one of the brightest in the world. The tour guide, Mark Martin, works at the Vieques Conservation and Historical Trust. Its mission is to preserve the bay. Martin says there are many reasons why these waters are so bright. One is the shape of the bay makes it hard for the glowing plankton to escape.
The vitamin levels, the nutrient levels, the water temperature, the water quality, it's all kind of perfect for them. And that type of water and that amount of plankton is sort of trapped in there. It can't get out. But mostly it stays kind of floating around in a great situation.
Scientists say bays like this one are rare. Chemicals from boat fuel and pesticide runoff can kill plankton, and bright lights can outshine bioluminescence. Edie Witter is president of the Ocean Research and Conservation Association. She says this bay is valuable because it helps scientists understand how people affect coastal zones. To gauge how healthy the bay is, scientists just need to measure how bright or dim it is.
And so it is the perfect canary in the coal mine in terms of being able to monitor a very delicately balanced ecosystem and see how humans are impacting it in a variety of different ways.
Since the Navy left Vieques, vacationers and retirees have flocked to the island. New houses dot the landscape, and the number of hotel room bookings tripled to more than 34,000 last year alone. It's a welcome development on an island that has an annual median family income of just $9,000. Conservationist Mark Martin says ecotourism is important to the island's economy, so he and his colleagues have begun taking local residents out in the bioluminescent bay.
And it's the best convincing strategy. If you let them see it, everybody falls in love with it. Nobody doesn't like it, you know. And they kind of get like a pride and an inspiration to say, hey, we got to protect this. It's the best way.
A new Vieques law requires people to shield their outdoor lights so the glow doesn't spread beyond their property. But Martin says efforts to create a development buffer zone around the bay haven't been as successful. He says ecotourism could provide the incentive that local government needs to protect Mosquito Bay.
It's pure magic. One of those things that captures everybody and turns them into little kids.
And then, he hopes, turns them into conservationists. For NPR News, I'm Ann Dornfeld.
The bathing's going to glow for a while.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Now for a murder mystery. The victims in this case are not humans, but they are revered by many humans. The weapon? Well, the weapon is an ordinary, usually non-lethal object. And the perpetrator? Well, that's the fascinating part. Our correspondent, Robert Krolwich, tells the tale from India.
Everybody tells you this, but when you see it with your own eyes, it's so weird. In almost any city in India, you can go to the busiest intersection with cabs and cars, sedans, rickshaws, people rushing about, and there, right in the middle of a six-lane thoroughfare, looking like she's in an alfalfa field, you will see a cow, or sometimes several cows.
Every city, they have sort of cattle population.
And these city cows, says Sunil Pandey, an environmental researcher in Delhi, they have owners who take them from a shed in the morning and then leave them in the city street.
It's so strange to imagine sending your cow out into the middle of a highway to have lunch.
Yes, this is true.
And the reason, of course, is that cows are revered in India. They are, say the Hindus, the mother of us all. So you can never, ever eat a cow or kill a cow.
Not at all. It is totally banned. Cow slaughter is totally banned in India.
Which is why, says journalist Subhash Mishra, it was such a shock to discover that city cows were suddenly and mysteriously dying all over India. The story began in 2000 in the city of Lucknow, where a police chief, a religious Hindu, reported a surprising increase in street cow deaths.
15 to 20 cows in a month in a city
Lucknow,
exactly.
And that hadn't happened before.
Or at least that had not happened.
So the police chief ordered a bunch of very sick cows who were near death to be taken to the hospital.
There they were operated upon.
Did they open up the tummy of the cow?
Yeah, exactly.
And when they looked inside to see what was going on, what they found were plastic bags.
Many bags. Like a dozen or 12, 15? More than 50, 60 bags.
60 bags?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. In some cows they found pounds and pounds of plastic. So apparently what was happening is so many plastic bags were being thrown onto the streets, and then the cows would come along.
They search for the food, right?
Right, and then this grocer says they'd see a bag, maybe with a little bit of mango showing.
They see the food inside.
Right, and they'd want the mango.
So they're so much hungry, they're too much hungry.
So instead of just eating the mango, they would eat the bag too. And if a cow eats bag after bag after bag after bag, the plastic blocks up its stomach and the cows starve. Now, in a Hindu country, killing cows, even with trash, is a national scandal.
It was, yeah. I mean, the cow in India, having the imagery that it does,
led to a wide movement to ban plastic bags, says teacher Leon Morenas. That so frightened the plastic industry in India, they quickly came up with an alternate solution. Why not, instead of banning plastic, let's make plastic thicker? Not that the cow would know.
That is an animal. They don't know what is in good quality and what is in bad quality.
Right, but the people who recycle the trash, they would know the difference. And there is a group of garbage collectors in India called rag pickers.
They are normally young children.
And they look through garbage and they sell the valuable stuff.
And it's normally sold by weight, and that's how they make a living.
So if plastic bags weighed more, rag pickers would make more money picking bags off the street, and that's why India's parliament passed a law that bans only very, very skinny plastic bags. The cutoff point is 20 microns. Any plastic bag 20 microns or less, banned. There's only one problem.
Do you know what a micron is or looks like?
No. I have no clue.
Neither do I. And I go to college. Leon went to college. A lot of people in India can't read or write. So maybe what they did was put a picture of a smiling cow or something on the good bags that says, this is an okay bag. So to find out, we went to the corner grocers and we looked.
Can you see anything?
No.
Anywhere?
Not at all.
There's no label. There's nothing.
So why not put a label on these things? I asked plastics expert Sunil Pandey.
Yeah, that makes life easier. But somehow, I mean, in the rules, this was not mentioned that bags should also be labeled.
And while the law did say that police should get some kind of micron detector to enforce the rules,
because of lack of funding, lack of finances, this was not done.
So instead, grocers make the rules in India. This grocer, Yashgupta Desai, says other groceries in the neighborhood, they sell skinny plastic, he calls them polythenes.
Those are cheap quality polythenes.
Oh,
cheap quality.
Is this a better quality?
This is better quality. That's why it is
cow resistant?
That's why we keep the best quality polythene so that it doesn't smell.
This is the best quality? It's not the best. Look at this.
I took a bag and it was so thin, I said to Leon, you know, anybody could poke a hole in this.
You want
to
see me?
Good. Go ahead. Let's see.
Here, you hold it in your two
hands. Okay.
Ready?
Yep.
Get set.
Easy.
You went through it.
Right through it.
And though it is still against the law to make very thin plastic bags, it turns out, according to Sunil Pandey's researchers,
to our surprise, we found that those bags are still manufactured.
So they still make them, and they still sell them, and there are more of them.
No one really cares anymore. Everything's given to you in plastic. Yeah.
Which gets us back finally to our cows. After 8 years, when you inquire at the Goshalas, India has retirement homes for cows?
These huge kind of orphanages for old cows.
Yeah. And old cows live with other old cows?
Yeah.
And when journalist Subhash Mishra asked how many cows are dying these days in Lucknow, he was told,
number has gone up as compared to 8-10 years back. Cows are still dying in the urban areas. They are still eating up plastic bags. They are depending on urban garbage.
So what exactly has been accomplished here? The plastic industry made a law and then ignored it.
Yeah.
People got upset, but then they lost interest.
Yeah.
And then the cows keep dying.
Yeah.
Whew. So,
well, but
I don't know if anything's happened.
Well, but that's, that's pretty much the case in India. Let's be honest about it. There's a little bit of hue and cry in the beginning, and then...
And then, like everywhere else in the world, you discover that what people say, that's one thing. But what they do, that's often a very different thing. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.